Can I ask you something? What's your family story worth to you? And I'm not talking about the shiny ones that everybody knows about. I mean the buried ones, the secrets, the heartbreaks, the ones that only slipped out after a night of too much Hennessy. That's what Vietnam Story Bank is for. No polish, no rewrites, no editing, just raw, recorded, beautiful beating history. The kind that makes you sit up and hold your breath. Your father's memories of his mother's wildest dreams, your grandparents' laughter that echoes in your bones. We dig it all up, we record it, and hand it back to you. Safe, untouchable, and unforgettable. Because when your stories disappear, they're gone forever. So go to VietnamStoryBank.com today and make sure your family's stories are recorded. Welcome to the Vietnamese Podcast. Today, my guest is Mai Whalen. She is the winner of the Squid Games Challenge on Netflix, the first season. Welcome to the Vietnamese Podcast.
Thank you for having me, Kenneth.
We share a common past, being in the military right out of high school. And I would love to start with why you joined the Navy right after high school.
Growing up in a very strict family background. And I was not able to do any of the activities like normal kids do. And so I was very confined and very sheltered. So I found an opportunity of leaving my family and do something I love to do is travel. So after seeing, you know, The Officer and the Gentleman with Richard Gere, I was like, you know, this is what I want. maybe the actor had a little bit of influence, but anyways, of course in high school they also had a job fair. And so the recruiter came in, they set up their table. I said, Navy. And then I said, maybe. And then, of course, at the time, my brother, he was dating a girl who's about to join the Army. So I talked to her everything about the Army. I saw the commercial about the Army. And I love the physical strength of the Army because they, you know, going through, you know, the physical challenge. And I love anything that's physical challenge. And so I went to the Army recruiting station and there was nobody there. So the Navy recruiter saw me sitting there waiting for the Army recruiter to come in. He goes, he just like motioned me in. Come on in, come on in. And so he's like, so this is, you know, so you want to join the military? So do you have a specific branch that you want to join? I said, well, Army, because I like the physical challenge. But, well, Navy does too, you know. So he gave me, he talked to me about it, and he gave me a whole bunch of jobs, like what I want to do. I thought I want to become a nurse. And I thought about it. It's like, no, because blood really grossed me out. I feel faint. I feel like fainting every time I see blood. So I said, no. How about anything with paperwork? So he got me a job. Yes, you can, you know, do personnelman. But before I got there, he gave me into a seamanship program. It was undesignated. Dummy me. So I said, okay, whatever. I just want to get out of my house. So I signed up undesignated. And my first duty station was chipping paint the ship. It's like the lowest job you can get. I was like, oh. But, you know, but anyways, I striked the job of a personnelman that, besides, I wasn't a U.S. citizen at the time. I was still a green card holder. And so they gave me a job that doesn't require
security clearance.
And so they gave me, you know, personnelman. So then that's it. I stayed in, and then I met my husband in the military as well. And I stayed 20, and he stayed in for 20 some years. And that's how it goes, because I love the traveling. the Navy had to offer. And also it was fun at the time. I really enjoyed my 20 years.
You know, your history, and you've stated it on the show, and you know, in Wikipedia, it all says that at 19, you got pregnant and your family cut you off. How is you and your family today?
Oh, after a few years of trying to patch things up, and you know, a lot, you know, they had a, you know, how the Asian culture is. They're very, especially my family, they were very strict. So after 2 years, I was trying to patch things up, and I brought my daughter to California, and then everybody started, you know, loving her. And then the relationship got better because, you know, they saw my child. And then they just can't disown me for the rest of my life because I have a child. So they need to understand that it's part of my life now. So it was a hard learning curve for me, and also a redemption from my family. So I don't know what I'd do without my family, because I'm all about family. I love having family, you know, get together, reunion, everything. And so having them, not having them in my life, it was very disheartening. It broke my heart.
Yeah, I can imagine. As a Vietnamese person, it's everything to us. Our families are, I mean, I'm sure other cultures are the same, but, you know, when I heard that story, I was like itching to find out, like, where did it land eventually, you know, because that shapes up who we become, right?
Mm-hmm. You have to be resilient. And that even though you don't have the family support, I mean, it's my life. I have to live my life. I have to live for my daughter's life. So with or without them, I have to move on. I'm not going to just, you know, stop my life because they didn't approve of what I become and what I... So I just, like, you know, if they love me, they're going to eventually going to open the doors for me. But at the time, I just, like, I was struggling being a single parent, too. So it was hard. Kind of having no family. All I have is my friends. And they can only help so much, you know. And then so push come to shove, you know, just and then, of course, I met my husband, who accepted my daughter, which is a big chapter in my life. I think also being in the Asian culture, being a single parent is a no-no. And the first thing they would say, nobody's going to want you because you have a child already. And so having my first, you know, my first husband, I think that's when the walls start breaking down. It's like, okay, she can have a husband who can take care of her daughter. So everything was like helping me to get my family back.
You eventually did 20 years in the Navy and got out and became an adjudicator, which is a tough word. And what I understand is you basically were sitting in front of people that were coming into the country, and you're trying to figure out if they were going to be granted visas or not. And I bring this up, I bring the Navy up, the history with, you know, you're being pregnant at 19 and this story, because it all shapes to me your skill set for the gameplay. It sets up this sort of this universe for me to understand the context. And I think the adjudicator part of it for me is a huge leverage for somebody who's going into a game like this Squid Game. So can you tell me a little bit about the work that you did then?
So, you know, everything adds up in my life to be in the game where I can just, you know, dissect my life, where my skill sets are, what are my mindsets. And so having the Navy, which is giving discipline, and also, you know, with my background of a very strict Catholic family, I've learned to know that I know the walks of life in the Navy because you have all walks of life in the Navy. So, you know, a lot of my friends are all over the world, you know, it's all different ethnicity. So that helped me learn about their culture. And then being an adjudicator also, it's like a complete 360 of I was immigrant. Now I am working behind the desk to bring immigrant in. So it was like, it's like a dream come true for me because I know how the immigrants felt when they are trying to leave their poor country and get a better life. So I know everybody that put the application in, I know how they felt because I know how I felt, you know, being poor and broken and all that. So I'm still doing my job in a lawful way, but at the same time, I felt their urgent need to get a visa, to come to the United States, to get an opportunity. So all of these skill sets from, you know, growing up, Navy, adjudicator, as an adjudicator, I was able to read people because that's what they taught us, you know, because even during the interview, you have to talk to immigrants to see if they lie, they scam you just to get a visa come in the country. So they taught us how, you know, all the body languages and, you know, so how to read people, if they're nervous or not. So that helped me in the Squid Game, the challenge, you know, to able to observe, first of all, not talk so much, but observe and just get people personality. So from that, I gathered, you know, in my head, it's like, okay, this is the person I want to trust. This is a person, you know, be nice to them. And that this person you don't trust. So there's a lot of parameters for me to weed out, you know, during my whole 3 weeks on the show. And so, and which in the circle of trust, you know, it helped me a lot to pick, you know, the person who put the coffin on my desk because, you know, during the whole time he was just looking at me. He's like, why do you look so guilty? So on the show, I was like, okay, you know, I didn't even go around and try to question people or, you know, and or try to examine them or interrogate. And then I just go straight, this is him. And of course, the production, the camera crew or the director, he goes, no, you can't just do that. That's too quick. So I have to go around the circle. Why? I don't feel this, you know, these people are not, you know, didn't put the coffin on my desk. Why is this person put a coffin on my desk? So I have to do, you know, have to do a retake of going, you know, for me to go around the circle. But I knew right away, I said, that's him.
How did you actually get to audition for the show and what was the process like?
So I didn't know anything about it. I know I love the series. I love the first season. I was so I just love the game and I love the mind games and the challenge that they're going through. And I binge watched actually. At first I didn't want to watch because it was gory, right? It was bloody. I don't like gory stuff. And my husband insisted. He goes, you should watch the show. So I did. I watched the first episode. Get over the gory. And then I binge watched the whole series. I mean, the first season in 2 days. And so, and then my husband's like, guess what? There's a casting call for Squid Game the Challenge. So I said, what? So I went online. I did my 1 minute video and I submitted it. I didn't even hesitate. So it took 6 months for the application process. And I didn't find out until the week before I flew out to London to, you know, to be on the show.
Okay, so you upload your 1 minute audition and you just, what do? They call you back a few times? How does this work?
So they call me, I submitted in June. They call me back in August for a first interview. It was the first Zoom interview. And I was so nervous and I was like, I'm a quiet person. And when they did an interview and at the end, she goes, can you be more bubblier? I said, that's what I said. Oh, I didn't get it because I was like, you know, I'm just a quiet person. I don't, I mean, I can be funny, but I just like my personality, like, you know, like they want that.
did they make you do any battery of tests or anything? Like personality?
No, they did the interview, and then the second interview, they want to make sure that, you know, this, how I'm going to do, I guess first interview to see if I'm qualified to be in. And the second interview, I don't know why they do a second interview. And then they did a physical test, psychological test. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of, as you can tell, it's a lot of mind games, and it's really break people down. It broke me down.
Yeah.
But, you know, after, let me see what else. And then physical, psychological, and then that was it. And then they did a background check, and then they checked all my, I didn't have any social media before I came on the show. I didn't have any. And then they said, "You don't have any social media?" I said, "No." "Are you sure?" I was like, "Yes." So I waited after August, and then in October, that's when they said, "Hey, you know, we got to do some more background check and then do a psychology or psychological test and just an interview just to see how you talk, what's your attitude. If they talk to you about certain subject, how do you feel about certain things?" And then I waited after October. I waited all the way to December. They said, "Oh, there's the results going to come out, but don't count on it because you haven't picked yet." I was like, "Okay."
You know, I want to save this question, but I just have to like ask it, because I was like wondering the whole time when I was watching the show, as I'm preparing questions for the show, for the podcast, how much of the feeling that you're going to win this was inside you at all?
I didn't come on the show to win, because, like, you know, it's like, it's so hard, right? It's 456 players, you know, that you're going to be up against. There's no way that I'm allowed positiveness, you know, to tell me that, "Oh, I'm going to win this. I'm going to win this." There's no way. And the only thing I tell myself is, you know, I was observing to see what kind of demographic, you know, a lot of people like coming to London. I said, "Oh, okay. They have old people, so I feel good. There's a lot of females. I feel good about that. And there's old ladies, and, you know, and then I said, "Oh, I'm in their age group." So I was like, "Whew!" Like, so I was doing a process of elimination already to see what kind of game they're going to be playing, because they have all walks of life, all ages, like, you know, all ethnicity, and all, you know. So it was an even balance for the game. So I wasn't worried about what kind of physical, because they can't put like tug of war or something like that, because there's no way, you know, the people who are older, they can play that. But no, I did not walk into the game and thinking that I would be the winner. I'm just happy that what motivates me every day is to see the set, because the set is amazing. Yeah, I said, if I can get through this set and I go on to next set, that's my motivation. Because after Red Light, Green Light, we didn't get to go to the dorm yet. So I said, "Okay, if I finish this game, I get." And then they said, "Okay, now you go to the dormitory." I said, "Oh my gosh, it's like a stepping stone of each set." So that's my mentality. Is if I can hang on so I can see the set. It's not about winning. It's about seeing a set.
So simple. So simple. Next step.
If you have such a high ego, and then you set yourself for failure, right? And then you're gonna be very sad because you got eliminated. I said, so even during my interview for the show, I said, "Are you gonna celebrate?" I said, no, I'm not going to celebrate because I'm not the winner yet. I'm like, you're in the top 10. You're in the top 5. You're in the top 3. I said, I'm not going to celebrate.
They were asking you this as you were going along?
Yeah.
Are you going to celebrate? Why do you think they asked you that?
No, because, you know, because people feel happy, right? I mean, you're in the top 10. Top 10 out of 456 players. A lot of people are like, yes, yes. You know, they're all gung-ho and they're all motivated and say, yes, I'm going to be the winner or I'm going to be this and that. I did not, you know, say that. I said, I'm just very grateful just to see another set. That's what I keep telling them. I said, I'm very grateful to see another set.
A lot of this stuff has something to do with luck too, right?
Yes, luck has a percentage in there. But then you have to, you know, like I said, you have to dive into your skill set also. I mean, luck can't say that you can weed out the bad person, the good player or the strong player, right? So you have to form in your head, strategize who you want to be with, who you want to work with, and who you want to trust. And then who you want to eliminate and all that. It's a lot of, you know, going on in my head. I mean, I'm surprised that I was able to sleep because I don't think I could sleep because my head is so stressful. Try to think of what's the next game. Who is the next person who's going to get eliminated? Who's going to be my best friend? Who's going to, you know, it's like, it's all keep on going. So after 3 weeks on the show, my husband took me somewhere that is nice and quiet, away from people, big city. We went to a farm and I slept the whole week because I was sleep deprivation.
That is nuts.
Yeah. Because I constantly eat, sleep, and think about the game, the people, what's going to be next and how they're going to process all of this, how I'm going to do this, you know, how am I going to stay alive? So.
You know, I know this is a really random question, but at any time throughout those 3 weeks, did you ever think that you were like representing Vietnamese people?
No, because there were Vietnamese on the show too, right? And we were, you know, and I tried to make the, you know, the homies bond, you know, it's like just because of we're in the same culture and, you know, we have similar upbringing and, you know, the food, the everything, the language. So I was trying to go around, trying to find all the Vietnamese people. And so we were, you know, I was able to make friends with them. And so it's, I never thought that I represent for, you know, my age group, you know, my sex, my ethnic. And everything, you know, I went from woman, age, ethnicity, and height. Because I was short. I'm only 4'11".
So you're representing all those categories.
Yeah. And everybody's like, I nobody knew or nobody thought that I would win.
You know, I tell you, when you're watching it as an audience member and you're seeing like a Vietnamese woman up there and you're just like, you, like people, you know, my world is, you know, we're just like rooting for you because, you know, it's one of our own. And it's not like a physical thing. It's like brains, character, you know, just like skill. And we're like, that's a Vietnamese person killing it up there, you know?
Yeah.
So that's why I was thinking, I mean, I'd like at any point, does she know that she's got the, you know, the Vietnamese culture on her shoulders? But yeah,
I did not think anything other than, you know, just survive. I was on the surviving mode as like how to live to see the next day and not to get eliminated. I didn't think anything of it until towards the end. It's like, oh my gosh, you know, until I won. And then I realized like, oh my gosh, you know, up until this day, I was like, you know, I'm, you know, pinch me. I'm still in a dream or something because there's no way I could have won this game.
It's insane.
Yeah.
And when I look at the maybe like episode 7, 8, when they start focusing and highlighting you a little bit more and you have to make these decisions and you were like really close to somebody who got eliminated. I think his name was James. I'm not sure what it is.
James, yeah.
James, okay, yeah. He was eliminated they dropped him, you know, on the bridge.
Yes.
He just like, yeah. And you like were, you were just like torn to pieces. How can you walk me through sort of like what was going on emotionally and, you know, the bond and losing somebody like that? I mean, you were in tears, like you were really broken up. And I wanted to say, what was going on in your heart at the time?
Well, I knew you meant, is it Chad or is it James?
I have, in my notes, it says James on the bridge.
Oh, okay, James. Okay. So during the 3 weeks, you have you sequestered for 3 weeks. So for me, you sequestered for 3 weeks. So everybody who talked to you, you shared your life with, because you don't have any, you know, other mode of communication other than the people that's in the dormitory. So you just, everybody just express their background, how they felt, what they went through as a child. I mean, they, you learn everybody from childhood all the way up to now, because it's so emotional. I mean, it's highly emotionally charged because everybody was sharing their life, you know? And so, you know, as you go on each day, you know what kind of people you want to talk to, or, you know, or keep, make friends or keep at a distance. And like I told you, and James just came across to me as a very, very sincere. He and I talked during Red Light Green Light. That's when I first met him, because he taught English in Korea. So everybody came to him to say, hey, you know, where's she singing? And of course, he translated to, you know, to English. And then that's when I first met him. It was during Red Light, Green Light. But then in the dormitory, everybody was trying to make friends with all kinds of people and all over, you know, all people. And then, of course, James and I, you know, as each day passed, we became closer and closer, because he's a very sincere guy and he have a heart of gold. And I tend to draw to that kind of people who's not selfish, who's very loving and caring. And so so he and I just bonded. And I want to, on the bridge, I wanted him to make it through. You know, I mean, I said, if I was so lucky with telling Chad to jump, maybe I can tell James to jump too. And I was like, maybe that's when I feel too confident. And then my confidence, like I told you, when you're too confident, and then it bites you in the butt. And then that's when you're like, oh, shit, why do I open my big mouth? I should never say anything. I should let him decide what to go, right or left. But I wanted to save James. And when he fell, my world just shattered. It's like, it was my fault. And I keep telling him, if to this day, I say, I'm sorry, Jane, it was my fault. You should never listen. And he goes, no, no, it's not your fault. You know, either you tell me or I would make that decision to probably jump and I'm going to fall anyway. It wasn't just my time, you know, but he's very humble. But I still feel bad that I got him out, because I was screaming right across the bridge. Like, you know, I felt confident. I was like, I know it's in my gut, but it wasn't. It was in my gut to tell, and I told him the wrong move. So yeah, so I cried sincerely, because, you know, like I said, you were emotionally charged with afraid of being by yourself again. And this brings me back all the way back, you know, when I was in the Navy by myself. You know, I was raising a child by myself. So everything by myself, I think I feel that I'm a failure. So having no one on the set with me to give me a root of confidence or cheer me on when I'm down. So little by little, all the people in my group got eliminated. So I'm, you know, my anxiety inside, like, oh my gosh, I have no one left. So the only person that was left was Chad. And of course, during that dice game, he went to sacrifice himself and he got eliminated. That's why I just lost it. This is the last, you know, the last guy who been with me from day one. Now he got eliminated. That's why I just went to as hysterical. It's like, that's why I'm like, they just, I'm going to be, you know, eaten up alive by a pack of wolves. And that's how I felt because I had no one there.
Do you keep in close contact with all of these former contestants that you were close with?
Yes, they are like family to me. So, yeah. And it's a bond that I don't think it can ever break.
Really? Because it's like
that deep. Because you share that deep-rooted emotional background of, you know, telling about your life, what they went through. I mean, their struggles too, you know. Like I have a friend, he came out and he finally told his family the day before he went to London to film the show, and they ignored him. They didn't want to do anything with him. So he shared that emotion, you know, his feeling, what he felt. His family disowned him because of that. I said, I felt you. I feel your pain because, you know, I was disowned too because they didn't believe I have a, you know, I could be a single parent. Especially, you know, my family, they're kind of very prejudicial too. It's like, oh, not only you have a child, but it's a black child. So everything add up in my family. It's like, that's why it was so hard. Even them to fathom. It's like, how can you have, join the military, that's bad enough, right? Because my family, you know, feels that any woman going to the military is a bad girl, you know? I mean, that's a lot of names they call me just because I joined the military. A lot of bad names. So when they found out I got pregnant, guess what? I told you so, and it won't let me down. And then, of course, having a black child doesn't ease the pain of, or ease the prejudicial, you know, of what they felt for me anyway. So it was ongoing. And then, you know, deep down, they have to learn to accept my daughter and who she is. And she's a great, you know, she's a great person with a big heart. So everything's all good now.
My mornings are chaos. I need coffee that works as hard as I do. That's why I drink Everyday Dose, coffee with benefits. It's rich, delicious coffee boosted with mushrooms, collagen, and nootropics. Everything I need for focus and balance, ready in 30 seconds. The Black Friday sale is on. Get 61% off your first coffee plus starter kit, a free A2 probiotic creamer, and over $100 in free gifts. Plus, enter for a chance to win $100 cash or get your entire order refunded. Visit everydaydose.com/podcast or use code podcast at checkout.
If you're the purchasing manager at a manufacturing plant, you know having a trusted partner makes all the difference. That's why, hands down, you count on Grainger for auto reordering. With on-time restocks, your team will have the cut-resistant gloves they need at the start of their shift. And you can end your day knowing they've got safety well in hand. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Have they learned to accept her now? Yeah.
She's 35. No, she's 38 now. So now, ever since I'm almost like set the trend in my family or something, because, you know, now my sister's dating a black guy. they cool with anything now. I mean, it's like it's everything that's throw on the table and nothing faze them anymore.
You know, and I think that's the thing about the Vietnamese culture evolving. I come from a Vietnamese Catholic family as well. And I think that part of the journey of leaving the country is to have this like next group of Vietnamese people kind of like grow and evolve into a better understanding of humanity, you know, because we're locked into the country of our origin. All this prejudice it builds up, you know, this anti, and a lot of us still have it. Even in America, we still are racist against black people. And I don't know how else to really, you know, answer to all of this
prejudice unless we go through it ourselves and have Black babies. And
I think the best way is to jump in with your feet in the water and see how, and when you surface and see how everybody reacts. Because if you always afraid of what your family thinks, then never change won't happen. So I'm always been the Black sheep in the family. I always like against the grain of everything what they believe in. And even, you know, I got yelled at for at the Vietnamese funeral for wearing sleeveless shirt when, you know, when you're, but I wear all Black, but they said, you can't wear a sleeveless shirt. I said, that's disrespectful. You have to wear long sleeve, you know, and jacket. And it's like, no, it's like, I'm paying my respect. It doesn't matter if my arm's showing or not. It's just an arm. I mean, that's what the purpose is. Arm is, it's there. And it's not like I'm trying to show my skin or anything. It just, you know, I was traveling. I didn't have, you know, any long sleeve shirt. And I was in the summer. I feel that the sleeveless Black shirt was due. But oh my God, I got yelled at. I got yelled at in my 30s or in my 20s. Like, I'm an adult. Why are you guys treating me like I'm a child? Anyway, so just because out of respect for everybody during the funeral, so I just buy a jacket, or I got a jacket for somebody, put it on. But it was like that. It was the culture of the old regime thinking, you know? And so I got to change that paradigm.
Speaking of change, what do you think the experience of going through Squid Games, those 3 weeks, changed or revealed about who you are to yourself?
I'm a very quiet person. I kept a lot within myself because there were a lot of things happened in my life that there's no sense talking to anyone other than to an American. Maybe, yeah, they've empathized with me, but the people that matter most that I'm holding it back in is my family. So if I can't share that with them, and so I was thinking, you know, during the interview, it's like they asked me a very personal question, and I just blurted out. I was like, it feels so good to release all of that on TV because they're gonna watch it. That's how I express myself. On TV, so they know how I felt, what I went through, and just to let them know. And it felt good to release all of that feelings inside of me for what, over 50 years.
And the chance that you had to do it was on this TV show.
I know. If it weren't for the TV show, I still have that, you know, I'm going to be all inside of me till the day I die.
And so did the transformation in your family happen when you came back to see them in person after they saw the show? Like, how did they get transformed? Or did they ever get what sounded like they did get transformed?
It didn't faze them. Didn't say no.
It did or did not?
They didn't say, oh, I'm sorry, that's how you felt, like, you know, a normal person would, no, American person would do. Didn't say anything. And then they would say, yeah, they had nothing to say. They had nothing to say to me.
You know, and I'm wondering, you know, when we all, I'm sure everybody who's listening to this, who's Vietnamese, understand this dilemma that we have. And sometimes I'm like, okay, do you lack the thought? Do you lack the language? Or do you entirely like not feel this? Is it not in your construct to understand like somebody's going through immense pain because of your judgment?
I think it's the old culture that it's just, you know, they've been so... They went through a lot with their life too, you know, growing up. I mean, especially my mom, my dad, they went through, you know, a lot of wars, you know, the revolution, the French, you know, the Vietnamese War, my dad to Korean War, the World War II. He was born in 1926. So he'd been through all of that. He saw so many things that because of the hard life that he went through, I guess his heart was like turning cold, you know? It's all about go to college, be successful, take care of your family. That was it. That's a three pillar. Don't care about love. Don't care about emotion. Nothing. You go to school, take care of your family. That's it. I'm married to the same Vietnamese person. I'm married to an American. Of course, I'm married to an American. My gosh, my mom and my dad. My dad took my husband, my first husband, in his room. He screamed at him. He said, "How dare you marry to my, you know, my daughter? I don't accept you. You're American. You're not welcome here." This is the first time that my husband or my ex-husband met my dad for the first time. And this is what he said to him. "You're not my son-in-law. You're not welcome here. I would never welcome you here." And so, of course, my mother heard all of this. She went into the bedroom, pulled my ex-husband out, tell him that this is, I was like, "I love him. I accept him. Don't listen to her dad." Like, ignore him. But, you know, but it, my mom grew up hard. She had a hard life too, also. But everything is, I guess, it's the norm. Not to show your feeling, to be ice and not to express anything. But eventually, you know, once they left Vietnam, it's chipping away of their heart, of the hardened heart, and make them softer, you know, make feel like their heart is, you know, is beating for feelings, for love, for an opinion, instead of hold it all inside, what they don't like, what they like, all of that.
But I tell you what, though, it's crazy hearing you say all this, because when I was watching the show, the feeling I got about you was this stone cold, hard, like, ability to like flip the switch and turn all of that off and even go for your best friends and just kill, right? That ability is so apparent in when you watch the show, and your ability to kind of like flip the switch and say, "This is all business. I'm sorry. This is a game and I'm here to play it at the highest level, and I'm able to switch off my emotions." Maybe a lot of that had to do with the way you were raised, perhaps.
That- a lot to do with how I raised, because even, you know, I'm always on a survival mode ever since I was a kid, you know, because I'm the youngest of 13, swept aside all the time, because all of my siblings, the older siblings, they have a job, they have school, they have something. So it's just me, you know, play with the kids or shove me to the side. And there wasn't any, once in a while, they would take me out. This is what they said when I was younger in Vietnam. But I didn't have all of that, you know, because my mom was trying to survive. We were very poor. And so she's trying to, you know, sell food on the street. And my dad, he was all over getting, you know, working, travel. He never home. So I don't have that father figure. I don't have that mother figure. All that's left is my older sibling to watch me.
And did they all become like successful doctors and lawyers, the typical success stories in America?
No. So they are successful in a way that they had their jobs, mostly or factory jobs, but because of when they save money, you know, being poor, they save every penny. So that give them an opportunity to buy a house, get a car. But none of us like don't have the profession of a lawyer or doctors, but my nephews and my nieces, they are doctors, and one, you know, studying to become a lawyer, and but my sister and my brothers, no, we always labor. It's all labor job. But they venture off into like importing, exporting, and they do acupuncture now. And it's like, so it's not about getting occupation, about a self-made, a business.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you ever go back to Vietnam?
I did. I went back there in October of 2023 because we, my brother, my only brother that was left in, still in Vietnam, he was sick. So he didn't want to be found for almost over 20 some years. And when they did find him, he was sick, very sick. So my brother, I met with my brother and in to go back to Vietnam to visit him. And he didn't have a house. I mean, he didn't have a place to live. He was living up in the attic with no furniture. It was hot. I mean, he was just terrible. He had no money. So we decided to, you know, help him monthly to make sure he has a roof over his head, some furniture, clothes, food, medication. So so he's still sick. He's the only one there. He's alienate himself from his kids because he abandoned his kids. And, but when I was there, I tried to have the kids and him come together, make peace. He have nothing to do with that. See what I mean? It's that hard again. Yeah. But he doesn't want to do that. But the heart is so hard that he can't even break that, you know? That's my family. That's the background of my family.
And it sounds like a lot of Vietnamese families, a lot of Asian families are like that. That inability to kind of break through that cultural binding.
Yeah, it's like I can't live like that, you know? I try, my dad is a very devout Catholic, but yet at the same time, he's not that, you know? He doesn't love. And being a Catholic is to love. And he doesn't know how to love.
No, they're very different things in the Catholic religion. The Vietnamese Catholics, it's a very different thing. It's a lot of it is saving face. A lot of it is being why. It's on the outside. You want to look good to the community. It's counterculture to what Jesus Christ really preached.
Exactly. And so when I was like really down in the pit of my life, I mean, when I went bankrupt and everything else with my business, and that's when I learned about or renew my spiritual life again. That's when I learned that, you know, Jesus was my savior. And, you know, I was praying, I was going to church, I was like redefining and who I am, and what I can become and what I'm going to give up for to have a new life that I can live with myself, you know?
How old are you?
So I was in my 40s, early 40s. That's when I went through with cancer, my third husband. And I was like having this reflection and looking back at my life, it's like, how did I throw all of that out? All my sin and all of my, you know, materialistic world, bury it. And so I come out better, you know. And my family can't understand why. It's like I have become a more spiritual person, more faith in the Catholic. I'm not so much like the organized religion, but I have faith and I do, you know, my spiritual side is stronger than ever, you know, but they don't understand that. So why are you turning into religion? And then of course my sister, she became a Buddhist because of married life because of husbands, because they're married to Buddhists. And he said, well, priests, you know, they have a lot of sin. How can you confess sin to a priest that has sin? I was like, yes, they're human before they become a priest, but you can't judge them, right? You can't judge anyone because everybody's at fault or makes sin in their lifetime. Nobody's perfect. So, but God said that, you know, Jesus said to confess. And, you know, anyway, I'm trying to make a point to my family that a person can change spiritually, whether, you know, if that person has flaw or, you know, you still want to express yourself to another person when you feel down and, you know, to open up to somebody who can actually listens to you, because I can't do that with my family.
Yeah, that's why it was so crazy to me to look at your signature block on your emails, having a lot to do with the love and that kind of awareness. I was like, where is that from? That's not the person that I see on screen, right? It's like the tactical, like, killing on screen's very different from the love that you've shown on the podcast today. It's like everything you're talking about is really digging into this emotional part and really calling out to the heart. It's very different from your persona on screen.
Let me tell you something, Kenneth. So while the whole time I was there, I prayed, I say the rosary every night. Even when I say my rosary, I fell asleep, you know, but I wake up and say it again, you know, and I meditate in the morning because I get up early because I can't, I need time, that quietness, you know, away from everybody just to reflect, meditate, strategize my plan. How's this day going to, you know, pan out? And so, yeah, I prayed every day. I said my rosary pretty much every day. I prayed before to the game, after the game. I prayed constantly and that's it.
Wow. How has, I have a few more questions. I want to know, how has this experience changed you? But I also, my daughter, very innocent, she's 8, her name is Mia, and she actually asked me, can you ask her, because we were watching the show again last night, I had to watch it again. She said, can you ask her what she does with her money, the winnings? And I was like, yeah, that's not something we normally ask adults to ask each other. But, you know, I'm like, I'll ask, and she can always say no, or I bought a bunch of property or whatever. And I, you know, Mia asked, and so I'd asked to transfer that question onto you.
So, Mia, what do you think I did with the money after you saw the show? And what you see in the media is that, let me tell you, I bought a 15 acres for wildlife. I brought on 2 nonprofit organizations, starting out nonprofit organizations where they have nowhere to go to. You know, one is for mental health. I think having what I went through as, you know, growing up and now, I think mental health is not advertised enough or taken into the consideration that mental health is here, that people ignore mental health. So there's a mental health profit organization on my property and also a Pause for War, who trained dogs for first responder, military, active duty, and retirees. So because of their PTSD, they train dogs to help them navigate their life every day, because PTSD is real, and that's mental health. And so I'm trying to make this into about helping people to have regained their life back again, because I think it's the 3 pillars that I live by is people. I love animals and our environment. And Mia, our environment is, you know, our earth is really is dying, because we need to concentrate how to save our home. Not just a house overhead, but our home. This is what we rely on to live many, many, many years. So That's very important to me. So a lot of the money is to highlight small nonprofit organizations to give them a platform to share what they can do for the community. And I donate a lot of money.
Thank you so much for answering that. I wasn't expecting all that. Thank you. It's a really strong moral stance. You know, especially in light of like the administration that we're looking down as an adjudicator, deciding people's lives from that visa standpoint, and then now on the climate side, I can't imagine what you're thinking of with the way America, where we're going with all this.
I turn off. I'm trying to filter through any negativity, anything that's the administration's doing right now, because it's I cry. Instead of, you know, be angry, I cry and I pray a lot. And I said, you know, it's not in my hands, but I will save one animal at a time. I will save one person at a time. And I would do what I can to save to put back more trees. In my 15 acres, they cut down so many trees, and I'm growing back a lot of trees for it too, because we are taking the habitat, the animals' habitat, and building more houses. I say, how much more houses can we build? But what we need is the habitat for the animals. Without the animals, our ecosystem will fail us, you know? So I'm doing my part, what I can do in my power. But for the administration, all I can do is pray for them to do the right thing. And I'm just praying and praying and praying.
I learned so much about who you are today. And I can see sort of the progress that your journey in humanity is taking you, and where it's taking you, and why the universe gave you sort of the keys to allow for some things to change, like the environment and the helping with the animals and mental health. And I think hearing you talk about all of these wonderful topics today energizes, and I hope it energizes our audience and our community as well.
Yep. So I just hope that, you know how when we have a natural disaster, everybody come together because of the natural disaster. But I hope that our community come together in a normal day to day. We don't need a disaster to come together, but our community come together just for every day. And, you know, love is not just about having to come together because of a disaster. Love is every day. So reach out to your neighbors, reach out to your friends, even the strangers that you see in the streets, you know, just say hi to them. And you don't need, every day is a community that we need to live by.
Yeah, I don't think we need all that fancy organized religion, whether it's in Buddhism or Catholicism. Right. Because I'm very close to both those religions, actually. I think that there's a lot of beautiful principles in the Catholic religion. I grew up a Vietnamese Catholic. I practice a lot of Buddhist meditation now, daily, guided meditations. And I think that really at the end of the day, the universe is just asking us to love each other more.
Yep.
That's it. And we can all be different political stripes, and think the balance is good with all of that, but at the end of the day, when we as a country is out to kill, I think that's kind of like where we have to begin to draw the line. And you know, we got to really think about these Christian values or Buddhist values, and really ask ourselves, is all of this reflecting love? And I think that's the real big binding question.
Yeah, if there is more love out there, regardless of where you at, who you, what your background is, the bottom line is love. Love will heal all things.
All things, yeah. Mai, thank you so much once again. And if you ever have time and you'd like to come back on and talk more deeply about some of the things that you're pursuing, I'd love to have you back on the podcast.
Well, like, just to let you know, Kenneth, so I am, I got my memoir done right now. And so I'm talking to publishers to get it published. Once it's published, then if they, you know, if they want to know more about my life, if my book get into print, then I will let you know.
I think this is a wonderful approach. And I think that this is a start of, I really think this is a start for you to kind of like begin to change the world around you in close proximity. And there probably is a big reason you won the Squid Game challenge.
Yes. And I'm so grateful for the platform, because I think my platform helped the world to see that there is goodness, that you can do good with your life and not just materialistic. I think spiritual speaks volume.
Well, let's get this memoir out and get you back on the podcast when it comes out, and we'll talk more about the memoir. I would love to hear about it.
All right. Thanks, Kenneth.
Thanks, Maya. Talk to you soon.
Okay, bye.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.
If you're the purchasing manager at a manufacturing plant, you know having a trusted partner makes all the difference. That's why, hands down, you count on Grainger for auto reordering. With on-time restocks, your team will have the cut-resistant gloves they need at the start of their shift. And you can end your day knowing they've got safety well in hand. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.